out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 28th of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I'm joined today by my usual Friday co-host, and thankfully he's decided to drop by with us today on Wednesday, and that's Florian Geyer from Mysterium Fasces. Florian, how are you doing today, and how is Canada at the moment?
I'm doing quite well. Canada's in the throes of its kind of moody, fast springtime. So we're enjoying a little bit of the reprieve from the cold weather, and most of the piles of snow are beginning to melt. So if that's how you mean, then we're doing all right. Spiritually, yeah. We're about as bad as ever, still to the shock of many of my foreign friends.
Whenever you get down with what the politicians are doing, anything like that is happening, we can always just look outside and see nature, and that cheers us up, I find. And particularly in Canada, that's supposed to be a particularly beautiful part of the world. But what we're going to talk about first off today is an invasion that is planned for Europe and America. And the title of this is Negroes Planning for Mass Invasion of Europe and America. Up to two-thirds of sub-Saharan Africa's 1.1 billion Negroid population want to migrate to Europe or the United States, with millions planning to make their move within the next 5 years. Around half of the Negroids in Kenya, Tanzania, Senegal and South Africa, and three-quarters of those questioned in Ghana and Nigeria want to emigrate to the US or Europe, according to a study by the Pew Research Center published last Thursday. Around 40% of those in Senegal, Ghana and Nigeria who want to leave said they will be doing so in the next 5 years. At least 1 million sub-Saharan Negroids have already migrated to Europe between 2010 and 2017. That's just 7 years, and 1 million of them have ended up on the European continent. The majority, 970,000, claimed to be asylum seekers, and the remaining 30,000 is comprised of Africans who have arrived on student visas as resettled refugees or through family reunification. So 97,000 claim to be asylum seekers. They claim to be at war, and this is why they are having to come to Europe. So why are they not going to the nearest safe country? Is the whole of the African continent, is that in the middle of a war or something? No, it isn't. It's just an excuse to invade Europe. I mean, these are absolutely shocking figures, I think, Florian. Do you have much problem over there with, particularly with Negroes, or is it mainly Chinese that you have issues with in Canada?
In fact, we do, and we've been having more and more in recent years. It started around the time of the intervention in Somalia, where we began to accept masses of Somalian refugees. But it's a problem that I've noticed in my own life very particularly, where it's week by week and day by day. You can see the demographic shift, especially in things like public transportation and all that. You know, and I've had experiences recently where, like, you'll be riding the bus and it'll be like half Black African and then, you know, half Asiatic. And this is a phenomenon that I've observed literally come into bloom in the last 3 or 4 years. The demographics didn't have this level of intensity, except for very, very recently. But indeed, as you point out, these people are not in any way, you know, refugees or asylum seekers. They're cynical economic migrants. And I think everybody knows that. I don't even think that regular people are under any illusion that Africa is in the midst of some, you know, embroiling genocide. They just think it's a bad place.
They just want to come to Europe. They just want to. They just want the gives me dats. They just want to take what we have. Two thirds of them are quite open about this and saying that they're making plans to come to Europe or America just within the next 5 years. I mean, they're already putting that into action. You think of those numbers, you know, 1.1 billion Negroes, and two thirds of them say that they want to come to Europe or the United States. And it just says here millions are planning to move within the next 5 years, but you don't know how many millions that is. That's obviously plural. All of them, I would say, want to move here. They've got two thirds of them that they say that they are saying are here. Maybe the other third of them out in the wilds, and they weren't able to actually ask them the question. But it is certain that that's what they want. And in terms of destination, Pew found that just four countries represent nearly three quarters of Europe's current Negroid invasion. The UK comes out on top at 1.27 million, followed by France, 980,000, Italy, 370,000, and Portugal, 360,000. And when you think about it, the United Kingdom is a very, very small country. 1.27 million. More Negroes came to Britain than any other country in Europe just in the last 7 years. And researchers found out that it is not just poverty or terror, notably committed by Boko Haram, that's Islamic State in Nigeria, and Al-Qaeda in West Africa. Yes, that's the same Al-Qaeda who are our allies in Syria. It is not just poverty or terror that is driving mass migration, but because Africans want to imitate their friends and relatives who have already successfully illegally immigrated to Europe. So they're saying there that what it's not just poverty, they say, or terror. Well, if they're asylum seekers, then they are claiming asylum because of war, so that's terror. And what they're saying here is that poverty is an equally acceptable reason for them to be invading Europe. But if they can't create wealth in their own land, how are they going to create it in a foreign land? And besides that, when you think of how rich Africa is, think of all the gems that they have, all the precious metals that they have, oil, gas, gold. The place is just full of riches, and they cannot create any wealth of their own there. They just want to come to our lands and take our wealth, and they will go about that in any way that they can. They will claim they're being persecuted for being homosexual. They will claim that they are being persecuted by Muslims. They will claim that they are being persecuted by Christians. Doesn't matter what they claim. The basic aim of what they are doing is wanting to take what we have. And the more of them that come over here, the more they will just turn Europe and America into Africa. And another problem is the miscegenation. I mean, you were talking just then, Florian, about seeing the Chinese and seeing the Africans on the bus. Well, within 50 years, it's going to be a crossbreed of the pair of them. It's going to be chiggers that are on the bus. And, you're just going to end up with a blend of peoples, a horrible mongrelized blend of peoples with no loyalty to the country they are in and no ability to actually create anything for themselves. If they had an ability to create for themselves, they wouldn't be claiming poverty and fleeing into Europe, would they?
No, indeed. I mean, and this is what it comes back to, is that it's naked self-aggrandization. I mean, everybody, this is the difference, I think, perhaps between these African migrants and the quote-unquote Syrian refugees, is that at least in the one instance, there's some vague, plausible possibility that they could be fleeing from violence. Although, as you quite correctly point out, Turkey is a great big country with no violence occurring in the midst of it that they seem to have skipped right over in their hunt across the Dardanelles. But in Africa, I mean, it's understood that these people are basically want to come to our countries and enjoy our infrastructure and reap the benefits of our wealth. There's so many different angles to analyze this from, but the hard pragmatic reality is that this is essentially, if this trend is not stopped, I mean, it spells an incredibly bloody and disastrous future for Africans and Europeans both. Because the nature of the the nature of the continent is that these countries in West Africa are experiencing massive population growth. I mean, it's expected to be 2 billion Africans if the growth continues without cessation until the end of the century. And so this area of the world where they're, you know, they're increasing by leaps and bounds in terms of their population are now sending their excess and specifically disgruntled young men to the West, where they can leech and parasite off of these countries with no problem for the host government. And they have an endless supply of these listless and idle young Negro men. And so it's essentially a situation where if there is not when the whole circumstance started, I remember some commentator made the comment quite correctly that if the first boats which had tried to approach, you know, the Italian peninsula or had illegally had been warned off, and if they had persisted in their attempts to, you know, come to the shore, they had been sunk, that would have been the end of it right there. That the deterrence, if there had been a hard border policy to begin with, none of these problems would be blossoming. But that's, of course, not at all what occurred, that by design, these people were let in because precisely this deracinated, mongrelized, listless, atomized future is the future that the technocratic elite, which are in control of the Western, you know, finance power establishment, that they want to see. They want to see people lose anything that binds them to anything transcendental and be reduced to essentially the level of, you know, economic animals controlled through their passions with a smattering of a few kind of, you know, autistic, you know, Asiatic white elites to program the robots that will police all of the Negroes.
It's very hard to come conclusion, isn't it, really, when you see what's going on around us. You have to think, well, this is being done deliberately to us. And when you look at the measures that they're talking about putting in place to prevent this, they are laughable. They're just going to increase all the more. Migrants from Cameroon, Nigeria, Senegal, and Ghana included pregnant women, the young, and single men on their way to Europe. I mean, what are they going to do work-wise? Pregnant women, young and single men with no education whatsoever. They're all on their way to Europe. Well, they told the German newspaper, Die Welt, we do everything we can to go to paradise. So they look at Europe as being some kind of paradise that's paved with gold, that is going to give them a credit card. They're just going to be able to put that in a machine, take out all the money they want, buy whatever they want, sleep with as many white women as they can find, because all the white women are sluts, according to them, and this is their paradise. And there are an estimated 50,000 migrants in Morocco and between 400,000 and 1 million in Libya who are preparing to illegally cross the Mediterranean to invade Spain and Italy before continuing their rape and pillage northwards to the wealthier nations in the European Union. And their birth rates are up to 7 children per woman. And by 2050, Africa's population is expected to double. So if it's 1.1 billion at the moment of these Negroes, it's not going to be 2 billion by the end of the century. It's going to be 2 billion by 2050. Just, 32 years away, they're going to double. So by the end of the century, they're going to quadruple at least. I mean, this is an exponential rate that they are breeding at. The demographic development is a ticking time bomb. The EU's ambassador to Niger, Raul Matias Paula, told Die Welt, if this development is not stopped, it could lead to a disaster, he said, noting that all attempts to deter African migration have not caught on. The EU is already plugging funds into the continent to prevent what the German newspaper referred to as the second phase of migration, with 600 million euros being made available to Niger alone by 2020. Ambassador Paula called the preventative measures a drop in the ocean, saying that every impoverished country in Africa would need financial support. And besides the political instability and institutionalized corruption of many of these nations, it would take years for the measures to stem the tide of mass migration out of the continent. Well, I would suggest that the more funds that they give to these countries to help them improve, it's just the easier they make it for their inhabitants to then make it across to Europe and America. They've been continually putting funds into these countries, and it doesn't do anything. Doesn't do anything to help whatsoever. Africa is already rich, as we were saying, in resources. What they're talking about doing here is bribing them. And bribing them is not going to help in any way whatsoever. And the reason why their birth rate is increasing at such a rate is because we've given them medicine, which checks all the diseases that normally would have slowed down the birth rate. We give them food because they're incapable of getting it for themselves. And again, they just increase the birth rate. And if they are hungry at the time, the niglets that they produce are all even lower IQs than the African average. All the children that were born in Ethiopia when they were having that the famine and Band-Aid and Live Aid, they sent all this money and all this food over to Africa. And all the Negroids that were born all had IQs of around 50 and 60. Now, absolutely impossible to actually do any work or do anything productive. And the reason for that is because they didn't have enough nutrition at the time. Yet they still were breeding. This is the thing. They were still breeding more and more and more of them. That's what you need to stop. And you're certainly not going to stop it by giving them more money, by trying to increase the standards of living in their countries. That's just going to cause more of them to remain alive. I mean, it sounds harsh, but really, you know, you need a cull. And if you can't cull them, then what you have to do is just withdraw all the funds and say, look, you have to stand on your own two legs. And then nature will just do it naturally for them. But we have to do something to stop this invasion of Europe and America, because if we don't, you know, we are going to be wiped out by this. And there is no way that the lefties can argue against this, because this is just common logic. You know, this is just statistics and figures and what this alien race wish to do. They've made their desires extremely clear. They want to come to Europe and America. Florian, is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that I would almost describe the situation we're in as fatalistic, because the system that has been erected in the West has no interest in implementing the necessary border controls that would prevent a massive influx of Volkswanderung from invading our countries. And in fact, they're doing quite the opposite. They're encouraging their invasion. They're facilitating their invasion. And the, you know, the paltry bribes that they give to Nigerians for their own moral superiority and to, you know, launder money and engage in human trafficking, you know, are not going to be effective solutions, as we've already gone over. And so demographics is destiny. And so, the nature of if they can't feed themselves now, well, how are they going to be able to do it when there's 2 billion Africans and you've got starving young men who are willing to, you know, murder for grain? I foresee, right? I think that the situation is only going to get worse. And so it's basically, we're in a position now where if we want to secure an existence for our people, a future for white children, just in the most basic existential manner, it's going to require likely an entire dramatic shift in the manner in which we govern ourselves so that these policies can be stopped. Because I don't see that happening without, you know, any I don't see that happening without a drastic shift of circumstances, which is going to occur. And so when the crisis started happening, it was horrifying, frankly, to me, because I could see from the beginning that it's just blood, that they're lining themselves up for a bloody future of conflict, of racial conflict. That would be worse, I think, than anything that we've ever seen before because of the scale. Because as the resources dwindle, these groups are just going to compete for ever more scarce and scarce resources, and the natural outcome of that diversity and proximity is conflict. The other thing I would say is that if our listeners have not seen the excellent documentary entitled Empire of Dust, which is available on YouTube, I would highly recommend and suggest you go and watch it. It's, for those of you who aren't aware, it's about a Chinese road crew trying to build roads in the Congo. And so the Chinese ex-military engineer supervisor has to spend all of his time basically dealing with the realities of conducting business in the Congo. And by the end of the film, you could see he's just gotten exasperated after having to deal over and over and over again with this kind of Negro monkey business, where he says to the, you know, his translator, who can speak Chinese in a very thick Negro accent, apparently, I've been told, it was quite funny, that he, you know, the Belgians left you with this whole country and you've done nothing for 100 years to maintain your infrastructure. and that these are the same roads that we're trying to implement now are the roads that that we're trying to improve now are the roads that the Belgians themselves laid in when they left the country.
That sounds quite entertaining. So, I think I'm going to watch that.
Yeah, anybody who hasn't seen it, it's great. I have family members of mine who have spent time working in Africa and in the Caribbean, and they say that it's extremely, extremely accurate as to how actually dealing with Negroes in their natural environment in a work setting is. So, yeah.
It's the same in India with the railways there. After the British left, they still haven't finished the railways. It's the same in all these non-white countries. When white people are there, we build the infrastructure, and as soon as it's handed over to the indigenous inhabitants, things just stagnate. They don't maintain things. They don't build anything new. Now, to move on to another subject, we've got rather a topical one next, and this is the word Easter has been removed from Easter eggs. This is from the UK. Pro-European Union supermarket chain Sainsbury's has opted to swap the term Easter eggs for chocolate eggs, telling customers that this is a more accurate description of the product. The statement triggered a public backlash, who felt the supermarket was commercializing a traditional holiday and erasing its Christian roots unacceptably. The move follows a similar controversy at Christmas, where rival supermarket Tesco ran a Christmas advertising campaign branded hashtag everyone is welcome, which featured a gay couple with a child, men in Sikh dress pulling Christmas crackers, and even a family of pious hijab-wearing Muslims who practiced child veiling, but no visibly Christian characters or symbols. Discount retailer Lidl, too, was subject to Europe-wide protests after customers realised it was airbrushing pictures of Santorini's iconic churches used to decorate their range of Greek products in order to remove their crosses. "We are a company that respects diversity," they said, "and this is what explains the design of this packaging," although it later submitted to public pressure and said that it would change the packaging. Now, this has been discussed on the terrestrial television today over here in Britain, and all the people are discussing it are saying, well, who would be against Easter? Who is it that's, causing this political correctness? Why would anyone be against Easter? And of course, it's Muslims and Jews. They are the people, particularly Jews. I mean, this is a time when Christ was resurrected from the cross, and we're reminded that Christ beat the Jews. So, of course, the Jews don't want to be reminded of that, the same as they don't want to be reminded of Christmas. And the same thing with Islam. Islam says that it wasn't actually Christ on the cross. It was some kind of doppelganger. And, of course, he wasn't resurrected. So, again, this is fundamental to the Christian faith and fundamental to Christendom and our civilization. If you go back looking in history, everything was based on belief in the resurrection of Christ and our eventual resurrection when we die. And now they're just removing it from Easter eggs and not saying who's actually doing this, but it's Muslims and Jews that are behind it. And we are seeing this with everything. Everything's being secularized as far as Christianity is concerned. And as far as Islam is concerned, that's encouraged. And obviously the same with Judaism, that huge great menorah outside the White House, but no obviously Christian imagery allowed anywhere. Have you got any tales to tell about Easter over there in Canada, Florian? Has there been any political correctness concerning it over there?
Well, not in terms of kind of high profile stuff, although to be fair, I don't read a lot of local Canadian news, mostly for the sake of my sanity. So I'm not aware if they're rebranding Easter eggs. But I mean, this is certainly part of an integrated effort to, of course, de-Christianize our culture. And I mean, you're quite correct, Sven, that the resurrection of Christ, which Easter celebrates, is the very essence of the Christian religion. That without, St. Paul says quite directly, if the resurrection is not true, then our faith is in vain and we are to be pitied most of all. And so this kind of goes right back to the very heart of these religious conflicts, is that did Christ come back from the dead or not? And the answer to this question essentially determines whether or not things that he said in his life and what his apostles said about him are true or not. And that's why both Muslims and Jews deny the central dogma of the resurrection. On a larger level, I mean, it's just, this is, you know, I mean, Easter eggs are a they're thousands of years old tradition. They go back even into, you know, pre-Christian times. And we see this not just in England, but we also, it's interesting. I was talking to some Russian friends of mine about this the other day because they have the very same tradition, Romania as well, where they all paint eggs around springtime. And it's a symbol of course, you know, fertility, I mean, and nutrition. But for Christians, when you're keeping the fast strictly, in an Orthodox sense, you abstain from eggs throughout Great Lent. So it's your first opportunity to eat them. But just like with the symbol of the rabbit, these are ancient symbols of the emergence of springtime, of new life, of the potential for growth, of fertility. I mean, people are encouraged to produce life, right? I mean, because the victory of Christ in the resurrection is over death itself. It's that life triumphs eternally over death and has created a way through Hades into eternal life for those who enter into death in this world. And so that's the whole message. And so to, you know, I think it kind of, the delight of the, you know, the feasting comes from, you know, the soberness and the austerity of the fast and of the illumination that the resurrection of Christ gives to our material world. These are all implicit in it. So to remove the religious connotations of the celebration reduces it to basically like wickedness. If it's just, you know, some, you know, hedonistic chocolate egg that we eat because, it's springtime. You know, I mean, it's totally less than empty of meaning. It becomes anti-meaning because it's feasting for the things of this world when the very promise of the resurrection of Easter is that there are better things to come. And this is what we have to set our heart of hearts upon and strive to acquire as humbly as we can within our day-to-day lives. And so, I mean, the thing is these sort of things, they seem like small things, but this is the wallpaper of people's, you know, life. Because, I mean, at least there's the, when you have an Easter egg, there's the pretense and the implication that it's about a larger cultural and religious event, even if people are not religious or cultural themselves. When you destroy this, there's not even that background. There's not even the implication. You know, and I mean, it's kind of the difference between a culture which is, you know, debauched and degenerate, but knows at some level that, you know, drunkenness and licentiousness and whatever are wrong, and then a culture which elevates and celebrates those things as virtues.
Yeah, it just becomes about gluttony. Yeah, it just becomes about, you know, I like the way you mentioned there about denying yourself beforehand, and then you have the feast, and of course, you know, that's when, you know, you really appreciate the fact that you are having a feast is when you've stopped eating and fasted for some time before. Well, I think we've got time for another story here, and this is about the Saudis. And this is the Saudis claim the West funded the spread of Wahhabism. The Saudi-funded spread of Wahhabism began as a result of Western countries asking Riyadh to help counter the Soviet Union during the Cold War, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told the Washington Post. Speaking to the paper, bin Salman said that Saudi Arabia's Western allies urged the country to invest in mosques and madrasas overseas during the Cold War in an effort to prevent encroachment in Muslim countries by the Soviet Union. He added that successive Saudi governments had lost track of that effort, saying, "We have to get it all back." Bin Salman also said that funding now comes mostly from Saudi-based foundations rather than from the government. Now, I think that's quite sinister, that the fact that they're saying that this comes from foundations, Florin, because these foundations, you don't know who is funding them. If it's the Saudi government, at least they can say, well, this comes from the Saudi government, even though, you know, they are not the sort of people we would want to be funding things in our countries. But just foundations that could be any extremist charity that they have over there in Saudi Arabia, I find quite concerning. But at least he's being honest and saying that it was the West that set up these extremist movements and actually funded them, the mosques and madrasas to be built overseas. I mean, it's pretty shocking stuff that he's actually saying this in this interview. And he also talks about Jared Kushner. Go on, do you want to say something about that, Florin?
I was just going to say that I touch on this often on Mysterium Fasces when we discuss Middle Eastern geopolitics, that if you know, in order to understand where the problems of today come from, you have to kind of go back to the end of World War I and Lawrence of Arabia and Sykes-Picot and the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have to understand the, how these things came about. And the Saudi monarchy was selected by the British government to, you know, reign over the territory of Arabia because they knew that they would be cooperative. And the, you know, British monarchy, or not the British monarchy, that's kind of a bit of a, an exaggeration, but rather the British intelligence services and so on, they actively promoted the spread of the Muslim Brotherhood and integrated it into Freemasonry in order to advance their geopolitical interests. Because they, and this was one of the outcomes of World War I, they had destroyed the Ottoman state, which had traditionally been an ally of the United Kingdom. But the loss of the caliphate with the kind of crypto Jew revolutionary, you know, Ataturk, Young Turks revolution, meant that there was no longer a constraining Sunni kind of, you know, pope slash emperor type figure that Muslims could give their allegiance to. And what that meant is that everything was open to essentially decentralized manipulation and leadership. And it was a brilliant opportunity for intelligence services to direct the, you know, jihadi fervor of this Wahhabist kind of reform foundationalist, you know, species of Islam to their own ends and devices. And this is what the Crown Prince is saying quite overtly, that yes, the spread of Wahhabism, and by extension and implication, its more militant advocates, was a direct strategy of the Western intelligence services during the Cold War in order to manage their Middle Eastern influence.
Well, I think we can also see the Western influence just in the fact that they call themselves the royal family. They call themselves the royal prince and King Salman, whatever his name is. I mean, that's our traditions. That's European traditions. They don't have kings among the Arabs. They don't have kings in Afghanistan. And they only make kings in Saudi Arabia because they wanted the oil. Anyway, he later goes on to talk about Jared Kushner and mentioning that he has said in the past that he had Jared Kushner in his pocket. And then he tries to say that it would be really insane for him if he traded classified information with Kushner or tried to use him to advance Saudi interests. But I really don't see why it would be really insane for him to make use of the fact that he has Jared Kushner in his pocket. But yeah, I mean, it's just good that we're getting to hear this stuff, and we're getting to hear it confirmed with RT, which is where that came from. Florian, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.